Hi, I'm Brad Smith, and on Blogging Heads today, where I'm going to make mincemeat out of Heather Gerken and some of her ideas about Citizens United and money in politics.
I'm Heather Gerken. I'm a professor at Yale Law School. I teach election law and con law, and I'm actually really looking forward to doing this. I was in the Obama boiler room 2 days ago, which means I have not slept at all. But we actually all talk about how much we like Brad and admire Brad, even though he's occasionally wrong about campaign finance. And so it's nice to be doing this with him.
Yeah, I should probably say, I'm also a law professor. I've even got my school mug here, Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. I was smart enough to avoid any kind of war room, so I'll be fresher. And anyway, we should probably start talking about money and politics. People don't want to hear all this boring chit-chat. What lessons would you take from it, Heather?
Yeah, I feel like the lesson from 2008 was that it was the first time I've ever seen a ground game really work. The Obama campaign got outraised on the private money front, even though it did a lot of raising of party money. And it really made a bet that the way to beat that was to run a ground game. And no one's ever won a ground game at the presidential level. It's just unheard of. And yet, watching the operations, the ground game beat out the air game, and it ended up working. Although I should say, the ground game costs money too, so don't think that because there's money involved in running ads for that it doesn't involve a huge amount of resources.
Well, let me see if there's one thing we agree on, and I don't know how much we do, but that the amount of money isn't the problem per se. If there's a problem, it's how it's raised and what people have to do to raise it and what effect that has. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that statement. I think I think two things about the way progressives thinks about politics, which is just flat wrong. And so one is the sense that there's too much money in politics. You know, we spend a ton of money on stupid things like Doritos commercials and the Super Bowl. I mean, now I'm going to get a lot of hate mail, but you know, just we spend an inordinate amount of money on a lot of stuff that doesn't really matter. I'm happy to spend money on elections. I think it's useful to spend a lot of money in elections. The question is, where does the money come from, and does it affect the way politics and governance works going forward? But the second thing is, I am not one of those folks on the liberal side of the spectrum that hates money. And I think in some ways, the mistakes that progressives have long made in thinking about campaign finance reform is to think that the goal is to get all the money out of the system. And then we'll have some kind of genuine deliberative democracy and it'll all be clean and neat. And it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. And I think that the way to think about money in politics is how to harness it to make politics better, but not how to get it out of the system. That's just a mistake.
Well, one thing I think in this campaign, for example, I've noticed the last 24 hours there's been a whole spate of stories about how Karl Rove wasted all this money and the super PACs didn't decide everything and, you know, money didn't blow everybody away. And of course, one thing I've always said is, no, I don't really expect money to blow everybody away. Money, it's important and you got to have it to get a message out. But ultimately, it's not a substitute for message. It's not a substitute for having a good candidate. And I think we saw that here. And I think we did see the shortcomings ultimately of just television airtime. And one of the issues for these independent expenditure groups or super PACs or nonprofits, whatever they might be, is that they're not really equipped to do a ground game. And this is one area where their inability to coordinate efforts with the campaign, I think, really does come into play and hurt. So they can just keep running ads, and those can be useful. But, you know, people have so many sources of information now and get so much reinforcement for such a long period of time that the ads just aren't accomplishing much, I think.
Yeah, although I will just say I've seen a couple of these it's such a stupid journalist move. So you take one data point, which is a lot of money was spent on one side by the independent groups and they didn't happen to win. If the election had changed by just a couple of percentage points, we'd all be talking about how they were mad geniuses and bought the election. You know, so I just hate the way journalists do that. It's a mistake. I mean, the money obviously mattered and they are serious people on both sides of this issue who really cared about the money. And if it wasn't like the Democrats didn't think the money mattered, they just couldn't raise it as much for this cycle. They just didn't raise as much independent spending money as the Republicans did. They got shellacked on that front, and they were, you know, but it's not, I don't think anyone inside politics thought that the money didn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, the money matters, obviously, and again, you've got to have money to get a message out. You know, in the end, I think the total spending, when you add it all up on both sides, will be about even. I mean, the Obama campaign spent quite a bit more than the Romney campaign, but the Romney campaign had all these outside groups working for it that outraised Democrats. And I think there's a couple of effects here. You know, one thing is, The Democrats initially took the position following the president that we don't want you to give to these kinds of groups. And note that, by the way, this is the same thing that happened to Republicans in 2004 when Bush was president. Yep. And at that time, the hot issue was not super PACs. It was 527s, if people remember the 527 scare. And 527s were in many ways just forerunners of the super PAC. The big difference was that 527s couldn't say, vote for, you know, John Kerry. They could just say, John Kerry's a great guy, and George Bush is a slimeball failed president, so call him up and tell him that. And now the super PACs can just say flat out, do this, or, you know, vote for this guy, don't vote for that guy. And the Bush campaign really discouraged Republicans from giving to 527s in 2004. I'm beginning to wonder if it's something, you know, when you control the presidency, you have a lot of fundraising advantages for your campaign. And I think there's a natural tendency to want to kind of control things. You're the head of the party. You're used to being in control. You want everybody to fall in line and let you run it with your carefully planned strategy. And I think you lose some of that when you're the challenger. You know, after 2004, the Republicans got into that super PAC or the 527 game a bit more, and I think it kind of evened out a bit more. And I suspect that will happen here, that next time around Democrats will be playing that game more. They won't have an incumbent president. And I also think that over time, and we'll see what you think on this, I mean, my view has always been that super PACs will benefit the party that is not in power. That is, that party doesn't have some of the fundraising advantages of the presidency. And people, when they're out of power, tend to want to spend more money. You know, George Soros was more enthusiastic about spending money in 2004 than he was in 2012. I think you'll find that with some of the Republican people like Sheldon Adelson and so on. When they're out of power, you really want to give. But, you know, once you're in power, you know, the problems of the world don't seem quite so bad.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I also think the Democrats, I think the Democrats' view was that they made a mistake in not, I shouldn't say this as if I'm the person who's a spokesperson, but I think that the people who really care about politics and looked at the Republican advantage on the independent spending realized that the super PACs basically let you have your cake and eat it too. So you can do all the fundraising you want inside the party, you can do party building inside the party, and then you have these super PACs which are like shadow parties. And I think, Brad, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember in 2008 a lot of people thought that the incumbents were going to want to push back on the independent spending because they couldn't control it. And so the worry was, you know, some crazy billionaire comes in and runs an ad and steps on your message, and therefore it's all going to be a problem and the incumbents will want to control it. But now the incumbents have control over it because it's their guys who are running it. So for both parties, you have the people who ran the campaign last time running the super PAC. They're tightly integrated in almost every way. They're using each other's ad clips. They're running sometimes the same ads. They're using film. They're making appearances with one another. Even though there are coordination rules, those rules are so weak that now you get basically have a big fundraising arm, which allows you to raise a ton of money, and you can do your party building stuff. And so if I were an incumbent, I would think, what's wrong with this picture? Now I get both the advantages of both things. But I agree with you. The money comes from the people who are out because they want to be in.
Well, I think that, you know, from my perspective here, I think super PACs have generally been a good thing. And not just super PACs, for people who don't follow this at all, we probably should have done more like groundwork of things. You know, super PACs are like regular PACs. They take money in. They have to disclose all their donors, all their disbursements. The big difference is they can't give money to candidate campaigns. They can spend it only independently. And because they're only doing independent spending, they can raise and spend as much money as they want. That's the big difference, whereas a traditional PAC has limits on how much people can give to it. And then it can give money directly to candidates. And then the other big players now in the campaigns are nonprofit groups organized under Section C-4 or C-6 of the tax code. And these groups, C-6 are trade associations, C-5s are unions, and C-4s are nonprofits. And these groups can run advertisements. It can't be their primary purpose for being in business. Nobody quite knows what that means, but obviously they have to spend more money, or at least an awful lot of money, on other things. So it's kind of, if you were just giving money to a C-4 to try to directly affect politics, you'd essentially have a tax on that, in the sense that you could only, the C-4 could only actually spend about half of what you gave it on politics, probably something less than that. So those are your couple of basic frameworks. I think they've been good for politics. They are a result of the Citizens United case, and also of a case on which I was co-counsel called SpeechNow.org versus FEC. Our argument was that if George Soros can spend $10 million and Peter Lewis can spend $10 million, how come it is that at the moment the two of them sit down at a table and say, let's coordinate our efforts, they only spend $5,000 apiece? obviously others are going to disagree, and you might disagree, but I would say that in this election we had, as we did in 2010, more competition, more competitive seats. Candidates like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich were able to keep their campaign going. Their supporters got their message heard by more people. They didn't win, but they got heard, and they forced the debate. And I think that was a good thing. And I think it's very hard to argue this year that there were many races left on the table because people couldn't raise the money to compete. I remember in 2006, some of my Democratic lawyer friends were saying, you know, as much as we gained ground, we left a lot of races on the table because we just couldn't raise enough money to make them competitive, and they would have been out there. So I think it's been a good thing to have this. What do you think?
So I'll tell you, I feel differently about the super PACs and the C4s, but I would rather see the money inside the party rather than outside the party. So it's not a distaste about the money part of it. But the one thing about having it inside the party is, first, I think it's just good for party building, which is what really matters in terms of getting people to participate and turn out. And I hate to imagine a world where there's sort of an elite group of all the money people who are sort of setting the message and running the ads. And then my favorite people in the world, which is the party faithful, you know, the people who are doing the ground war. I want to see them in the same, under the same umbrella, in the same institution. I don't like to see this split where you have kind of the elite money politics in one part of the party, and then that's cabined off from the people who are actually, you know, the heart. I think that the party faithful are the heart and soul of the parties, and they're the ones that I'd like to see. I don't want to see them in some shell organization that just does GOTV. The other thing I'll just say about the C4s and C6s, the super PACs at least have disclosure rules, but the C4s and C6s have no disclosure right now. And I will just say, I mean, I'm very curious what you think about this, Brad, but you can write a giant check, and there's no disclosure whatsoever from who's paying for it, and I don't think that's a good thing for politics. So at the very least, there ought to be disclosure for the C4s and C6s. The one I want to ask you about that, Brad, and the second question I want to ask you is, do you really think that these organizations at Crossroads GPS is spending half of its money on non-political activities?
Well, there's a couple of different questions there, but yeah, that's what I was thinking is so where are we going to go? What do we do next? Let me go first and say, I sort of agree with you. I mean, I dislike the fact that people often call these groups outside groups, and they often say that with a little disdain, like this is like these are, you know, again, outsiders coming into our game.
It's just a different kind of insider.
Yeah, I'm like, these are U.S. citizens who want to participate, and especially when we think about groups like the Sierra Club or Planned Parenthood, which did a lot of advertising this cycle, or, you know, Right to Life. I heard a lot of ads from them, you know, the NRA. These are groups of citizens, the Chamber of Commerce, as businesses and so on. I don't think they should be viewed as outsiders to our elections. But and therefore, I'm not really in that sense. I don't think it's, you know, I don't want to sort of stop outside spending. Yet at the same time, I agree with you to the extent that I don't see why we should put our political parties and our candidates under sort of a handicap. Right now, under Supreme Court precedent, you really can't limit what these independent groups spend, but contributions to candidates can be limited. Contributions to parties are limited, so it can be harder for them to raise money. And our thought when we were prosecuting the SpeechNow.org case, the case that really allowed super PACs to be set up, was that once that happened, incumbents would no longer have an incentive to try to limit contributions because independent groups could spend as much as they want and raise it much more quickly. They'd have an incentive to loosen the rules on their own campaigns and make it easier for them to raise money. So far, that hasn't really happened, and we'll see if it does. I mean, I sort of hope it does. Most of the contribution limits are still not where they'd be if they'd been adjusted just for inflation since 1974. They range from about half of that to about a quarter or a fifth of what they'd be had they been adjusted for inflation. So I think that's one thing. I hope that will change. I think there are other things that can be done on the super PAC front that I wouldn't necessarily oppose. I'm not sure how crucial I think they are. You know, you asked the question, how much does the Karl Rove's group spend on their nonprofit activities? You know, to me, that's a legitimate tax issue, but it should be viewed as a tax issue, not a campaign finance issue. And that may require, you know, the IRS taking more action. I think one could pass a rule saying something like, you know, if you're a C4, you can't spend any money on politics until either you've been in business for a certain period of time, like 2 years or something, so that you'd be an NAACP or an NRA, that people know who you are, know what you're doing, that you've established that you have a function other than just political participation. Or at least alternatively until the IRS gives you a formal approval, because now you can just incorporate, say you're a C4 and start spending money. So, you know, I think there might be some value to say, well, these IRS actually has to approve it. And that wouldn't really even hamper groups that are just starting out, because they could still organize directly as a super PAC and you know, spend money on the political side if they wanted to do that. So that's one thing I think I might do, which would at least partially address the disclosure issues that you're talking about, and also the issue you raised regarding the rogue groups. And I have no idea what they spend, you know, the balance of their budget on, so I can't comment on that.
There are a lot of ad buys from Crossroads, and so it's very interesting to know.
And one thing is, you know, Heather, you know, the IRS hasn't even defined what is sort of the spending period over which this cannot be your primary purpose. Obviously, groups that have some social welfare purpose or educational purpose, but also do some political stuff, are going to do most of their political stuff in an election year, close to an election. So is the period, you know, each election year? Is it any 12-month calendar year period? Is it, you know, some 2-year election cycle? How do you determine what that is?
Yeah, I just to go back to that, I don't think we should have money that's being spent in massive quantities on elections without disclosure. I just think that's just that, and it doesn't matter what the, or if you're going to think about that question, you shouldn't have a world where there's disclosure for parties, disclosure for super PACs, but not disclosure for C4s and C6s, because there's only one thing that's going to happen, which is the money will all go there. I mean, this is the hydraulics problem. So I'd like to see disclosure on this, and I can imagine raising contribution limits for just the reason you said. I mean, I suspect we probably disagree on how high they ought to go. But again, I'd rather see the money inside the party than outside the party.
But what does disclosure mean then with the C4? I mean, let me take – this is a real-world situation. You've probably seen it. You know, I've worked with clients who do it. I mean, the Acme company gives money to, say, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce then says, well, we'll give some money to State Chamber of Commerce to help them get involved. We'll match what they raise. So State Chamber raises some money. U.S. Chamber sends them a check. Then the State Chamber sends a bunch of money to some other group, the State Business Alliance or something like that, which maybe includes other, you know, business trade groups and so on. And then they spend money in an election. So what is it that has to be reported? If we, you know, typically almost every state, the C4 that's spending the money has to report that they've spent the money, and they may have to report who their donors are, but their donors just going to show up as being, you know, the state chamber. And then if we ask the state chamber, well, who's your donor, was just going to show up as being, or at least part of it's going to show up as just being the U.S. chamber. You know, how far back up the chain do we want to go? These candidates or these companies have given up control of the money, these donors. They may not even agree with particular candidates or races involved. I think that's what some have called our friend, I think our mutual friend Joe Birkenstock calls it, the Russian nesting doll problem. And, you know, how would you try to get around that?
Yeah, it's a hard, I mean, it is no question a hard regulatory problem. On the other hand, we've dealt with shell organizations and trying to evade campaign finance rules for a long time. So, for example, one of the things, just very simple, is if you're going to give money to the Chamber of Commerce and it's going to go to advertising, it needs to be allocated as such, and you need to acknowledge that in advance. That's not that hard to do. It's a very simple accounting rule. But that's a way a lot of people get around this stuff, right? They just give it to the Chamber and let the Chamber run whatever ads they want, as if they didn't have any idea that the Chamber actually might be running ads that are going to be extremely helpful for their business interests. So you know, states have rules where you have to tell what it's for and allocate it accordingly. There's no reason we can't do that. These groups swish a lot of money around right now, and they don't need to keep track of it. But we know how to keep track of money. We do this in other contexts, and other organizations have figured out how to divide this stuff.
Well, let me ask you another question then. Okay, so back in the 50s and through the 60s, we had a whole bunch of decisions, mainly, not entirely, but mainly involving civil rights groups, right, in which those groups wanted to keep their donor list and their membership list private, in part because they feared both public and private harassment of those donors that would dry up their funds, right? Obviously, again, you know that, you know, the primary case is a case called NAACP versus Alabama, but there were a whole slew of cases. Bates v. Little Rock, to some extent Talley v. California was a civil rights case, NAACP v. Button, and so on. So, yeah. you know, do we want to – how much do we want to give that up? I mean, what I keep asking is, what do people really think they're going to learn from backing up through all these donors back up through the process? And it's true, we're not in the civil rights era now, but, you know, people still do have privacy interests. There are still problems with both official and private retaliation. And do we want to – you know, let's put it this way. Is it so far-fetched to imagine that in 5 or 6 years, say – financial supporters of Planned Parenthood suffer a series of bombings, or financial supporters of traditional marriage suffer a series of bombings at the homes of financial supporters, and then we're all going to say, oh, why do these people have to reveal that they gave money? And we're going to say, well, because a few years ago we were all worked up and we threw away the protections that we spent 2 decades earning of NAACP versus Alabama, the right of people to keep their political activity private.
Okay, so now we found a place where we really disagree.
I want people to watch.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, so to quote the vice president, this is just malarkey. The idea that we would draw an analogy between a big corporation in this day and age giving money to a campaign and the 1950s and 60s when people were getting lynched, I think is absurd. So I believe, as did Justice Scalia, that great conservative, that you know, politics ain't beanball. And it is true that people put pressure on others. But the only thing we've seen so far, and this is where the 2 cases that have gone up, one from California, and one that actually went to the Supreme Court on these questions, what we saw was called democracy. So we saw people talking to people who gave money to campaigns or supported something that they didn't agree with, which is what the First Amendment's all about. We did see some small level of consumer boycotts. And again, the consumer boycott, back to the lessons of the 50s, is a robust and cherished First Amendment tradition. So it can't be that consumer boycotts are the source of harassment. Now, of course, if there's violence, no one has any question about whether that should be regulated. And we have means of figuring that out. So, for example, the socialist workers are always exempted from disclosure rules because they actually get their tires slashed and they are able to produce evidence showing a real threat. But it's got to be a real threat. And we've seen no evidence whatsoever, even in the instances where there's been disclosure on hotly contested issues about which people are passionate. There's been no evidence at all of this kind of harassment. And so I get everyone wants to wrap themselves in the sort of cloak of the great civil rights icons. But this one I'm just not willing to see. I'm not willing to equate IBM or Target with people who were given to the NAACP in the 50s.
Well, you've got 2 issues here. I mean, one goes to corporations, so let's set those aside for a bit. The other goes to individuals. Let's remember, most of the money flowing into super PACs, for example, has come from individuals, right? So individuals are given this money. Obviously, they're pretty wealthy individuals, but you know, they are individuals. Now, I would suggest a couple things. First, that I think the evidence is not quite as rosy as you paint. I mean, we know, like in California, we know that people lost their jobs. We know of cases where people's businesses, where their employers were boycotted because employees of the firm on their own time gave money to the anti, you know, same-sex marriage movement. And so their firms were boycotted until those employees were dumped and gotten rid of. We know of at least one case where a terrorist group, a known FBI-designated terrorist group, was using the public disclosure form from campaign finance to pull names off the web, and they put a big web page up saying, now you know where to find them with these people's addresses. These people just worked for a company that this group didn't like and had given money to campaigns. And I've been on the FEC. I've seen what the Socialist Workers Party submits every few years, every 6 years or so. They have to go back and ask to keep their exemption. And the evidence they're submitting is really not that impressive. It's not much different. It's, well, you know, we had one of our members was told by police he couldn't set up his table to sell books on the sidewalk. You know, well, we had, you know, some members were meeting in a house and the police broke into the apartment below them, you know, things like that. It's not that impressive. I think, you know, given the sort of tenuous desire for people to participate in politics, and given the amount of vitriol we hear going on nowadays, there'd be a lot of people are going to have a desire not to have their political work put out. And if we think about the federal government keeping a database of your political activity, which is what we have here, I think most civil libertarians, you know, would find that pretty disturbing if we frame it in those terms.
So on the first thing, it is not a First Amendment problem if people are made to feel uncomfortable about their political position. So that's, so I believe that lots of people are made to feel uncomfortable, and that they're told, they're called names, all that stuff happens. And so I believe that to be true. But on both of the cases that have been, have gone up through the courts, the findings are by respected courts who sat down and sifted through all the evidence, that the evidence of harassment that people alleged were existed in those cases was just not there. And so, sure, if you can get the facts, if the facts are such that you start to show the kind of stuff that you're worried about, I don't think there's a person in the country who wouldn't support reducing disclosure and disclaimer rules in that context. But that is not what we've seen so far. And it's just not the way American politics works generally. People yell a lot. And they put pressure one on one another, but at the end of the day, this has not been the tenor of American politics generally. And until we really see that stuff happening, I'm not willing to give up on disclosure.
Well, I go back. You know, I mean, historically, though, people haven't had to disclose. And you know, one of the key differences here, like when we talk about boycotts and so on, is the idea that people should have, that the government should force people to disclose their political contributions, which enables folks to boycott them. And that's the primary reason this is going on now. And we think about this then, the boycotters then invoke the civil rights cases you mentioned to not have to disclose their supporters and who's giving them money. So you've got an asymmetrical scenario here. And at some point we've got to say, are we going to start requiring, you know, all Americans to disclose sort of everything they do and all the people they're dealing with and so on? Or at what point do we say, look, it's enough to know that the group that spent this money on politics, note that we're not without disclosure. I mean, if the Chamber of Commerce spends money, we know that's coming from the Chamber of Commerce, and everybody knows what the Chamber of Commerce is, and people know generally what their agenda is. So we have to balance the dangers that exist against what benefits we get. And I question whether we get much benefit from disclosure. You know, voters say they want disclosure, but the reality is when we survey them, they never actually use it or look it up. You know, what benefits are we getting? What are voters learning from this disclosure, and is it worth the cost?
Yeah, so I agree that you have to balance the cost and the benefits. I just think the benefits are much greater than you do. So if you can't trace the money, and there's a danger that the money is going to end up influencing politicians' decisions, that's a problem. And so if there are people who are able to write checks for $250 million, I think the odds are that most politicians would pay attention to that. We ought to know who they are at the very least. And I'm sort of with you. I mean, this is where Richard Befalt, our friend and colleague, made a smart point, which is in some ways we're giving people, forcing people to drink from a fire hose with regard to disclosure and disclaimer. And you have to, $50 donations, which are not going to corrupt anybody, have to be disclosed. And you, Brad, do this stuff for a living, right? So you know how, what a pain in the ass it is to put together all of that information. But we're not tracing the $10 million donations that run through the C4s and C6s. So I would rather see our efforts focused on the really big money, which is what really matters for purposes of thinking about corruption. I'm happy to make it easier on the you know, to the extent that people use a lot of this information, they use it to find out whether their professor donated to a party or not, which is not really the purpose. And so I'm with you on that. But the big money, we got to trace it.
Well, that's about where I was actually about to go. I was thinking the same thing, which is, you know, even though we might disagree again on exactly where the lines go, the beginning of coming together is to get people to realize it's not so easy as just to say, we need to disclose everything. But yeah, that actually begs the question of what needs to be disclosed. Do we need to, you know, do I need to disclose it if I write a letter and send it out to 50 friends of mine urging them to vote, you know, or something like that? I mean, you know, what kinds of messages need to be disclosed? And then we need to think about who should have to disclose. And I think it sounds like we would agree that the thresholds for disclosure should be raised. Again, the current, like, federal threshold hasn't been raised since 1979. You know, we could raise that, which I think would actually make the reporting that goes on more valuable, because you'd see who's really giving serious money, not every, you know, little nickel and dime contributor. And we might want to treat, like, corporations differently from individuals, thinking, you know, well, look, a corporation can take care of itself, or large donors. You know, we might, in other words, what I'm trying to get at is, I think this can be a fairly complex issue. And even where people might disagree at some point on principle, you know, recognizing politics is about compromise, there's probably an area that there could be an agreement on more disclosure than we currently have in some areas, maybe less in others, like less disclosure of these small dollar contributors, that would, you know, and nobody would get exactly what they want, but everybody would probably would be, in fact, a little bit happier on the whole game.
Yeah, and this is where I blame both the left and the right. So I'll blame the right on this one, which is that it used to be that when McCain-Feingold was passed, every Republican said, if we just had disclosure and disclaimer, we wouldn't need any of this. They were on the record on this question. Now the entire Republican Congress is against disclosures and disclaimers, which seems silly, right? So your guys ought to be helpful on this front. Meanwhile, the left has this absolutely crazy view that the more information, the better in all circumstances, not even thinking about, actually, you need information that's in a useful form that matters for what you're doing. So there, I think there is a lot of room for compromise for the Sensible Center if they can just shake off both the right and the left's kind of knee-jerk reactions on these questions. Now, can I ask you a question, Brad? What do you think about matching for small donors? Because my view is matching for small donors is a good thing. And the reason it's a good thing is because if you really want to reduce the influence of money on politics with the big money, you have to make sure that the money comes in from somewhere else, because otherwise people will keep hunting it. And it's nice to, it's a good thing to make politicians chase after small donors and care about small donors and not just spend all their time dialing for big dollars. So I'm a big fan of matching programs. I think that's the way you harness money to fix politics. It'll make for better politics. And I'm curious what your view is.
Well, I'm not sure it's necessarily a good thing to have campaigns funded by small donors. You know, a lot of the best small donors
that you were invoking just a few minutes ago.
Well, a lot of the best candidates at raising small dollar donations have been candidates who, I don't want to say they're out of the mainstream or anything, but they're sort of on the edges of the mainstream. I mean, Barry Goldwater is very good at it. George McGovern was very good at it for his time. You know, you start moving up to the ages. Oliver North and Pat Buchanan were very good at it. Howard Dean was very good at it. Oftentimes we find that the candidates who can raise small dollar donations the best, you know, are Michelle Bachmann.
I mean, Barack Obama.
I didn't, because Barack Obama, I think, would fit in as a bit more of a mainstream figure there. But a lot of the candidates who do, in other words, I don't think that just saying, well, I raise most of my money from small dollars necessarily makes you more of a mainstream or popular candidate than somebody else. I also think it's very important that candidates have the ability to get, you know, big contributions to get campaigns going. Now, if you're just talking about supplementing that, I become more open to it, you know, than if you're talking about trying again to keep make it harder for people to get the money they need to start their campaign. I think it should be much easier to raise the money to start a campaign. If you had to start a business and nobody give you more than a couple $1,000, you'd never get new businesses started. Sometimes you need somebody to be able to give you some larger amounts of money. The other thing that can, you know, I've been more in favor of the idea of just tax credits. You know, we used to have a tax credit for political contributions that would amount to, in today's dollars, about $350 for a joint return. And I think that kind of thing is probably good. I prefer it to matching funds, because I just think the government should really stay out of the business of dispersing money to candidates. When the government starts doing that, inevitably it starts putting strings on what people can do. You know, the reason we have this stupid you know, I'm Brad Smith and I approve this message on every ad now, is because the government put that on there. The stick, or the carrot, if you will, was to say, we'll guarantee you, we'll force broadcasters to give you a lower ad rate if you say that. And it's very clear from the record that incumbents wanted that on there because they thought there would be less negative campaigning. Well, they were wrong about that. But negative campaigning was bad for incumbents, and they were probably right about that. I mean, it was clearly a pro-incumbent measure when it was passed. And, you know, I just don't want to get the government involved in campaigns. I've been trying to press the idea that really the government should be out of the campaign business completely, and that in fact it shouldn't have authority. It has the authority in the Constitution to regulate the time, place, and manner of elections, not campaigning, which is just talking about politics. So I don't want the government be open at least to, you know, tax credits like we used to have in the code, not only because it gets more money, small dollars, into campaigns, but mainly because it sends the message to people that it's good to participate in politics. And I think too many of our citizens have gotten the message that it's bad to participate in politics.
Yeah, so if I may tease you just a little bit, you were worried about challengers. And if you worry about challengers, public finance isn't such a bad way to help out the challenger. So it's true that they can get money from private sources, but also public financing is very helpful for challengers, or at least we think it is. So what about the challengers? Should they get public money?
Well, I'm not sure it is that beneficial, primarily because it usually comes with some kind of effort to limit the amount that people can spend, and that limitation is usually put at a level that benefits incumbents. I mean, there's pretty good evidence that, you know, challengers will benefit from higher spending, at least to some point, that at very low levels of spending, incumbents benefit. So I'm not sure it benefits challengers, and I don't think the evidence from the states that have tried it, Arizona and Maine, you know, terribly supports that, or that it changes your group a lot. But if you didn't couple it with limitations on – try to couple it all the time with limitations on spending and so on, then it doesn't, so to speak, terribly offend my values if we were to say we're just going to have subsidies. And that's long been the ACLU's position, is that we should not put limits on what people can give to campaigns or spend, but we should offer public subsidies, which will allow more people to get into the game. And, you know, again, that might not be my preferred solution, but if that's where we ended up going, you know, to get certain other things, that's the kind of trade-off I'd be willing to make.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the worry about government, because it means also that incumbents are regulating themselves, and they almost always have an impulse to do it in a self-interested fashion. Sometimes their self-interest aligns with the American people, and sometimes it doesn't. But the stakes are so high. I mean, to have a completely non-regulated elections process, I have to say we've seen that before, and it didn't work so well. The Wild West of campaign finance leads to a great deal of corruption, so I don't mind that we actually have some law on the books and some government regulation. I don't see how you get around that problem.
Well, did it work so bad? I mean, we had a pretty good string of presidents through our history.
Then there was this moment called Watergate. I don't know if you noticed that one. But.
Well, you know, look, there was something called the Civil War, too. So should we give up on democracy? I mean, you know, everything has something that goes bad. I think Watergate is not, you know, there's always been this effort to say it's a campaign finance scandal. It's not. It's a criminal scandal, breaking into the other side's offices and then trying to cover it up. I mean, that's the real problem with Watergate. It's not a campaign finance issue. And, you know, as Gene McCarthy used to say, people always were upset because Clement Stone gave $2 million to Dick Nixon. And that's $2 million in 1968 dollars. But as Gene McCarthy used to say, hey, Clement Stone was a good influence on Richard Nixon. He was a moderating guy. You know, I don't think that, you know, basically we've had a 40-year experiment with heavy regulation, and I don't think that we have actually much to show for it. And I think these appeals back to Watergate are kind of, you know, wearing thin. Where has the improvement come since Watergate? We still have scandals. They still erupt every few years pertaining to, you know, corruption and campaign financing and so on. And I'm not sure we're getting much out of it.
Well, I will say, to be fair to the experiment, it wasn't run the way it was supposed to be run, thanks to Buckley versus Vallejo. So,
that's politics, man. Politics never goes how it's supposed to go.
But Buckley versus Vallejo, I mean, if we use Pam Carlin and Sima Zakharov's metaphor, you know, it basically said to politicians, you have a cap on contributions but not expenditures, which is like saying to a giant fat person, you know, here's an all-you-can-eat buffet, but you can only eat it with a teaspoon. And we all know what happens when that happens. So we haven't really run the experiment properly. And remarkably, no one's provided us a parallel universe to do it properly.
Well,
Brad, where does campaign finance go in 2016?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think the issue will be disclosure is going to be a hot issue. Again, I think some of the problems that people seem to be most concerned about should not be confused with campaign finance problems, like the idea of, you know, these C4s that form and people are concerned they're not really social welfare groups. To me, you know, that's a tax problem. It's not a campaign finance problem. It should be a taxed through the tax code and through the IRS doing it. I do think that there should be a movement to make it easier for the parties and politicians to raise money. I think contribution thresholds should be raised up to adjust closer for inflation. And I would like to make it easier for parties to spend in coordination with their own candidates. I think it's silly to drive this kind of artificial wedge between the party and its candidate, which then gets increasingly filled up, as you put out, by a super PAC run by the candidate's former, you know, top advisor. You know, those are the kinds of things that I think could get bipartisan support. But if the reform community comes at it and says, we want full public financing and we want, you know, all these limits again and so on, which has been the case for many times, you know, that's just not going to fly, certainly not in the next 2 years while Republicans control the House, and probably not in the next four, and you know, then we'd have to see after that. So I think something, if it were to be done, it would have to be modest disclosure measures that recognize that disclosure is not, you know, that easy line of just saying we want every penny disclosed, and something that would recognize that there is disagreement, and that is to say compromise rather than triumphalism. And that applies to both sides, again, as something you pointed out earlier.
Yeah, so how about a great trade? So contribution caps higher for the parties in exchange for disclosure, not just of the super PACs, but also the C4s and C6 donors when they're engaged in electioneering. But here's my question. So I get that you're worried about the coordination rules for parties and their candidates. That's a line of decisions that a lot of people don't like. But how about the coordination rules for the so-called independent organizations and the parties? I mean, Stephen Colbert has been brilliant on this front in showing just how much coordination of the sort that everyday people would call coordination doesn't constitute coordination under the existing rules. And it's my view, actually, that in the last 50 years, no one has done more for campaign finance reform than Stephen Colbert, other than Richard Nixon. So what about the coordination rules for the independent group?
A couple of things. First, Colbert has done some stuff I really like, stuff I've shown in my election law classes and so on. But I will say on some of the stuff he's done in coordination, I actually think he's wrong. I think his advisor, Trevor Potter, is wrong. I would never advise my
clients. Trevor is never wrong about anything.
Well, I would never advise my clients on those things. In fact, they have done things on the show arguing that this does not violate the law, which if I were an FEC commissioner, I think I would say, which I once was again, I think I would say that violates the law as it now stands. You cannot do that. You cannot, for example, have two people on the phone, one from the super PAC, one who's the candidate, pretending to talk to their lawyer while they're actually each talking to one another. That is a violation of the law. That's illegal coordination. But having said that, I think that there could be changes in the coordination rules as well, and I think it's really an FEC issue. You know, think about it. When we did Citizens or SpeechNow.org versus FEC, nobody thought, including the FEC, including the interveners who included John McCain and people like that, the reformers who intervened, nobody thought of the idea of a single candidate super PAC. Just nobody thought about that. And the FEC coordination rules were written long before then with the idea that, well, we shouldn't tell candidates that they can never go out and raise money for a PAC that is giving money to, their political allies, to members of the party, things like that. That's good for the party. So some of those kinds of rules could probably be addressed and changed, I think, in ways that would be realistic and effective and that I'd be prepared, to support. Right now, they've not been able to do that on the FEC. A lot of people say, the Republicans are intransigent. From what I can tell, the real problem has been that the Democratic commissioners insist on loading up such a rulemaking with a bunch of stuff that's unrelated to that narrow issue created by Citizens United. They want to try to enact a broad disclosure legislation through the FEC, and the Republicans won't go for that, and the Democrats won't agree to a narrow rule. But it doesn't really matter what the problem is, I guess. I think the FEC could address that, and I think they'd be smart. So.
I actually didn't hear that last bit that you just said, the last sentence.
She would be smart to address that, and I think they could. I think there is room for agreement on changes there that would affect some of the coordination rules to reflect the reality of super PACs, which, again, are a creation that came about after the FEC's coordination rules. So there may be a reason to have new coordination rules put into place.
Well, I guess the one thing we agree on is that the odds of that happening through the FEC are pretty slim right now, given the state that the organization is in. But I'm curious, as a former commissioner, so oftentimes when I teach campaign finance, I talk about the FEC as worst administrative agency or worst administrative agency in the world, to use another Colbert line. So what's your view on the current FEC? Is there any hope at all for doing anything in the next 6-7 years?
Well, I think, let me say generally, I think the FEC often gets a bad rep that's unfair. People say it's, set up for gridlock, and, it is long work without much gridlock. It forces compromise. The same people say it shouldn't be 3-3 because that sets it up for gridlock, then praise it whenever somebody expresses concerns about, one party dominating that important political process. They say, well, you can't. You have to have bipartisan support. You got to get 4 votes. You got to get somebody from the other side. So, I think generally it has, in fact, worked reasonably well, and the problems over the years have been the problems that are inherent in the campaign finance regime and the, sort of series of muddled court decisions, the court kind of swinging back and forth from time to time. As far as the current commission, I do think that they seem to be, at each other's throats too much, that they say things in public and in opinions that may not be helpful but I can't really comment. I don't know too much of what's going on there particularly. I think the system can be made to work. Again, it shouldn't be that much to ask for a coordination rule that's adopted to SpeechNow.org and Citizens United.
So before we close, can we talk a little bit about Citizens United? So I'm every time I do a speech on campaign finance or elections, I always get a question about Citizens United, which isn't really a question. It's a speech about why Citizens United is evil and the Supreme Court is evil, and then there's a question mark at the end. And I'm one of the skeptics on Citizens United. That is, I don't think that the overruling of Austin was nearly as important as people make it out to be. I actually think that what really mattered for Citizens United is what it said about corruption, not what it said about corporate speech, because as you said before, a well-advised corporation could run a lot of these ads, and they just couldn't end it with vote for or vote against someone. But I do think what the court said about corruption really matters, as you know, because you've been on these cases, right? Because the cases that have followed had all turned on what the court said about corruption. So going forward, do you think there's any chance the Supreme Court's going to reconsider its decision, or do you think we are in a post-Citizens United world on the corruption ruling as well?
I don't think there'll be a change, at least not with the current court personnel, of course. And as you know, earlier this summer, they summarily rejected a challenge from the state of Montana to the law. Montana tried to say, well, we're, you know, different circumstances. It's a state, not the federal government, and, you know, things like that. And so I think you'd have to see a change in who's on the Supreme Court before you'd see any kind of change there. One thing that I'm noticing, and actually I find kind of disturbing, is that there seems to be a growing tendency in some of the lower courts to ignore Citizens United and act as if it does not exist. And I think that's a problem. A decision just came out yesterday from the D.C. District Court, Federal District Court in D.C., which cited the Citizens United dissent as the grounds for denying the claim that had been brought by one of the independent defenders. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens there, but I don't know. I don't think you're going to see any immediate change. I don't think the court's going to back off that anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. The only way I could imagine was that I think Justice Kennedy contemplated there'd be more disclosure than there actually was because the regulations haven't kept up with the new reality. But I agree that I think they're pretty much set on the question itself. So now that we're being reasonable, should we end this?
Well, it's always nice to end on a point of agreement. If anybody's stuck with us through all this, hopefully they've learned a little bit, and they're probably saying, boy, when is this going to end? So maybe we should turn it off.
But that's the magic of the internet. They can just turn it off anytime, and they're done.
Well, that's true. So I guess we're done. It's been a pleasure, Heather. Always fun to talk.
Same here. It's nice to see you.
Okay. Bye-bye.